Welcome to the Classroom Podcast, the book club discussion on classic political philosophy. My name is Eric Nganyange. I'm your host and the student in this class, sitting here with the one and only Professor Ron Klein. Professor, how you feeling, man?
Man, I feel quite good.
Good.
We got a podcast to do. What could be better?
Hey, there you go. Oh, man, Charmides.
That's what we're doing.
Yes, sir. That's our conversation today. He was a son of Glaucon?
Yeah, not the Glaucon that is Plato's brother. It was a common name in ancient Athens. He was the son of a different Glaucon. He lost his parents, and I don't know why, but he became a ward of Critias, who's also in this dialogue and others, and there's a dialogue named after Critias. And Critias is not only his guardian, but he's his cousin. And people should also know that Charmides is actually Plato's uncle. Now, Plato hadn't been born prior to the setting of this
dialogue.
Right, dialogue. And Critias is also a cousin of Plato. Their families were sort of closely tied together. Probably we should tell folks what became of Charmides and Critias. They both broke bad at the end of the Peloponnesian War. The Spartans, as part of their settlement with Athens, set up an oligarchy to rule Athens. The oligarchy goes by the name the 30 Tyrants.
Yeah.
And Critias was head of the 30 Tyrants. And they were tyrants. They were bad people. But Charmides was also part of that.
Oh, Charmides was a part of
the
30 Tyrants?
So, So this is a guy we're talking to about Sophrosyne, one of the great virtues. And Critias, too. So they both went bad. You know, the 30 tyrants did awful things. They would call people in and kill them without any charges or trial or anything so they could take their money. I mean, that's the kind of people they were.
Wow.
And so the better people and people interested in a democracy in Athens fled because they didn't want to be killed. Socrates did not flee. He stayed in the city. No point in killing him for his money because he didn't have any. In the end, there were some Athenians that, after the tyrants were overthrown, were mad at Socrates for not leaving and joining the democratic faction. So that comes back to play in his trial. So at any rate, the 30 tyrants lasted for about 9 months. The pro-democracy forces were able to gather enough people together and enough armaments. So, but keep in mind that Charmides and Critias turned their cousins, and Critias is a guardian of Charmides, and they both turn out to be very bad people.
Wow. That when this conversation happened between Socrates and Charmides, I had a sense that Charmides either was in his late teens or early 20s. How old was he, roughly?
Yeah, roughly he's 17 or 18.
Okay.
Right? He's old enough to be out of school, but young enough so that he's not a citizen full-time in the sense that he can participate in the assembly. And moreover, he's still in basic training for the army.
Okay.
You didn't get into the regular army until you were 20. Now, being in the regular army is not volunteering for the army. That's required by law. So he's not got to that point.
Okay.
Those are relevant to where they are talking. Socrates is narrating this, right? He's telling the story of when I came back from Potidaea. Potidaea was the first battle of the Peloponnesian War, took place far north in Greece. And it was a siege more than anything else.
Yeah. Before you go any further, was the United States in the past did the same thing? All young people were required to go to the military?
No.
No? It was always volunteer?
No.
Okay.
there was a draft when it was required.
Okay.
And you had to sign up for the draft when you turned 18, just in case at some point there's a war and we'll have to call you into service.
Okay.
So to say that it wasn't a standing army as such.
Okay.
There were people who volunteered to be in the army, and they were the core of the army, but they were volunteers, but you could be drafted.
Okay.
It was really exciting during the Vietnam War because it was a lottery draft. I was in college at the time, and, you know, everybody's would prefer to stay in school rather than fight at Vietnam, and everybody's praying that their number doesn't come up. And
yeah,
it was always exciting when they drew the numbers.
What was the age gap? Was it from 18 to 25 to get called in?
Close, 18 to 26.
Okay.
Yeah, and if you got by 26, you were pretty safe. If you were married with children,
you're safe.
For some reason, weddings went up dramatically. also, people had a great interest in visiting Canada around that time. I knew people that took all those options.
Oh, wow. Wow. So back to Socrates. So he, how did he end up in Crisia's house in the first place to have this dialogue with Charmides? Because that's where the dialogue happened, did it?
No.
Okay.
It's interesting how Socrates starts the thing out. He says, I had just come back from Potidaea the day before, and the siege ended in a horrible battle, which was a defeat for the Athenians. And as he indicates in his early narration, a lot of Athenian soldiers were killed. So he says, I came back yesterday, and today I'm eagerly seeking my normal pleasure of talking to folks in the places I haunt in Athens, which are the Agora,
yeah,
right, which think of it as being a very, very large central park, okay? So easy to run across people to talk to there. And then he would go to the two gymnasiums. They were not gymnasiums like we have them, like YMCA things.
Yeah.
They were very large outdoor training areas where you could work out for sports. But more importantly, the people that went there mostly were people who were eligible to fight in the army, which is from 18 to 60. So since your life was going to depend on
your physique,
not maybe the physique, but, you know, that would have eliminated Socrates. But you wanted to be fit as you could be, because warfare, the way they fought it then, was just brutal. Strength and speed mattered a lot. And so people didn't have to be pushed to work out because their life might depend on it. So it's a busy place. So it's heaven for Socrates. I'll go talk to people there. I'll know some people, and that'll be nice. And then the third place he would go is to the palestra. And that's where they are, the palestra of Tarius.
Okay.
He was the owner. And a palestra is a workout place, but for boxing. It's smaller, much smaller. Boxing, an event called pancration, which is like mixed martial arts today.
Mm.
Very brutal. In official competitions, lots of bad injuries. People died sometimes. But again, if you were going to enroll in those kind of events, you wanted to be really tough.
Yeah.
Really tough. And so you would go. And people would be there to talk to. Same deal. Boxing was less brutal.
Yeah.
And wrestling.
Okay.
Wrestling as well. And it's wrestling in the sense not of the way we do it now. You pin your opponent's shoulders to the ground for, two, 3 seconds? Mm. It's just you throw them to the ground. If you can throw them to the ground, you win. We call it now Greco-Roman wrestling. You see it in the Olympic Games. So that's where he's at. He's at a palestra. Sure enough, he walks in, and there's his childhood buddy, Chaerephon. And so he sits around and answers her questions about the war. Then he says, you know, I'm always interested in talking to young men to see if there's anybody coming up that's particularly wise. People there unanimously, and Critias is sitting there, his guardian, remember, they say, oh, yeah, there's a guy you got to meet. That's Charmides, you know, 17, 18 years old. He's very Sophron. That is, he has the virtue Sophrosyne in abundance. He's the most Sophrosyne or most Sophron youngster in all the city of Athens. Okay, and then Critias, his guardian, speaks up and says, and besides that, he's a philosopher and quite a poet.
Yep.
So this gets Socrates all interested, right?
Yeah.
Got to talk to this kid. I can learn something from him.
Mm-hmm.
And remember, that's really mainly what he's trying to do.
Yeah.
So there's some artifice in how they get Socrates together with Charmides that has to do with a fake story about curing his headaches.
Yeah, yeah.
And that Socrates learned something up north in the battles that he could cure the headache that he had every morning.
Yeah, all of a sudden Socrates became a physician.
Yeah. Now, he's always called himself a physician of the soul,
mm-hmm.
but this is the first
time. It's just the body.
And this was all made up, by the way, with Critias. And it's amusing, right?
Mm-hmm.
The other amusing thing about that is, how do you end up with headaches every morning?
I cannot follow that part.
Hangovers. You drink too much the night before, you end up with a headache the next morning.
Every day?
Well, if you go out drinking every night.
I would not think that the way the description of Charmides, I did not think it would be doing that.
You wouldn't expect.
Yeah.
Right? Because that's not virtuous.
No.
Right? And
definitely that's not moderate. Moderation.
Definitely not moderation. Right. So that I'm glad you said that word, because we need to talk about that word Sophrosyne. People who comment on Plato's dialogues, who's lifetime students of them and write books about them, have come to the understanding that there's no single English word that you can put in place of Sophrosyne. It's too complicated an idea. And it's the one we're going to talk about, and hopefully we can come up with a simple, not one word, but two word definition that will help. So it's translated a number of ways. And every translator in the preface to their translation says, you know, I know there's no single word for Sophrosyne, but to make it easier to read, I'm going to pick one. And it's usually prudence, temperance, sound-mindedness, moderation.
Yeah.
You see those words all the time from translators who their job is to translate it into English. So remember that when I keep using the Greek word, there's a reason for that.
Mm.
If you possess the virtue Sophrosyne, you are said to be Sophron.
Okay.
So I hope that isn't too confusing.
I love the word moderation better.
Go for it.
So they convince Critias and other people, they convinced Socrates to talk to this guy. Oh, Socrates actually was interesting to talk to this young man, Charmides.
Oh, absolutely.
To see what he real knows and, like you say, what can Socrates learn from him.
Exactly.
So the conversation ended up being the word, the book they used, temperance.
Yes, another word.
Another word, I say moderation.
Okay.
So the young man step up, and I think the way the book described, he sat between Socrates and Critias.
Yep. Yeah, Critias on one side and Socrates on the other.
Yeah.
And that's not unimportant, because the whole dialogue isn't about Sophrosyne. That's the subtitle of it. And indeed, it's the start of the conversation, and it's the part you and I are going to cover. But we'll see at some point, Charmides sees he's not doing well in the conversation. He ends up basically saying, you know, guardian Critias, why don't you take over this discussion for me? And Critias is a very bright guy, by the way. Bad, but he's very bright. We have actually some parts of some of his works have survived.
Okay.
And so we know he was a very smart guy. But let's start with the first attempt at definition.
Yeah, so Socrates asked Archimedes, what is temperance?
Yep, that's all he wants to know, just a simple question. And he sort of, it's interesting how he phrases it, you know. He says, you're Sophron, you have this virtue, so you should be able to tell us what it's like to have it, and so tell us what it is. Charmides has an interesting definition. He says, I think, Socrates, it's doing everything in an orderly and quiet quietness. Way.
Yeah.
And so I would define it as being quietness.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting.
It's an interesting, we want to remember it. Now, Socrates, in addition to trying to find out some knowledge from Charmides, also wants to test and see how wise he is. And so right off, he attempts to refute that definition. And he says, tell me, Charmides, isn't it true that when you go to the writing master, which all Greek young men had to learn how to read and write, when you're writing your letters, isn't it more admirable if you can do it quickly? Well, yes. Well, and when you go to the palestra to do your gymnastic training, isn't it better if you do it quickly? Well, yes. And when you're going to your music teacher, which again, all young men in ancient Athens anyway, learned, yeah. When you're learning to play the lyre, isn't it more admirable to be able to pick it up quickly? And Charmides agrees. Yes, that's true. So if speed is more admirable than orderly and quiet can't be the definition, because Sophrosyne itself is admirable, and we said the opposite is admirable. Now, we should think very seriously about Socrates' refutation here. He took quiet to mean slow. Charmides didn't say orderly and slowly. He said orderly and quietly.
Yeah.
And so Charmides doesn't pick that up. He should have said, wait a minute, time out, Socrates. Yep. You know, I didn't say anything about slow. You're putting words into my mouth.
Yeah.
Right? That's
a. I didn't even pick that up.
We got to work on the fallacy detective harder.
That's true.
Yeah. Anyway, so there's that, and you would have expected he would have done that, and then the conversation would have taken somewhat of a different turn. And he also might have said, when I said quietly, I meant quietly in my mind, settled in my mind, right? And Socrates is talking about physical kind of things, right? So I wasn't talking about that kind of thing. I was talking about what was going on in my head. Okay, so he didn't pick that up either.
Why do you think Plato left it like that? For us to pick it up?
Exactly. These are
interesting
writings that he used in teaching at the academy. One of the things he wants to teach us, all of us, because we're all his students at the academy if we're reading his stuff, is find the mistakes.
So he used this at the academy? This dialogue?
I believe so.
Oh, so they will probably did this live. Probably reading it. Maybe he was trying to show people what do you think is going on there?
Exactly. And so lucky us, these works have survived, and we essentially have become students at Plato's Academy. No better school to learn in. All right. So but that definition, because Charmides agrees with what Socrates said, that definition goes away.
Yeah.
So what happens next? Well, and Socrates is encouraging him, you know, look into yourself and see what it's like to be Sophron, because everybody says you are, and look at the effect on you and see if you can determine the cause, and then tell us what it is. And so Charmides does try to do that. And he says, well, it kind of makes me feel like I could be ashamed.
Or modest.
Yeah, or or ill at ease. And so I think it's modesty.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Before you go to the second definition that Charmody gave. So let's say I'm Charmody and I'm coming back to you as a Socrates and I say, hold up, time out. You're talking about speed. I was talking about quietness. Mm-hmm. What would be the comeback for you?
From Socrates?
Yeah. Because you're Socrates now.
Oh, good. Thank you.
Because then everything you mentioned, I disqualify because you're talking about something completely different than what I meant.
Yeah, I suspect Socrates would change his line of refutation. We can see this happening, like in the Republic.
Yep.
Socrates would keep responding, maybe with false refutations, to see how you pick them up. And he's doing it again. How does he refute modesty as a claim to be sophrosyne? It's really easy. He does it very quickly. He says, well, Charmides, do you disagree with Homer when he says modesty is not a good mate for a needy man? So where does that appear in Homer? That's in the Odyssey, near the end. The speaker there is a young man named Telemachus. He's talking to Odysseus, who has finally arrived back on the island of Ithaca after 20 years. And he got Athena to give him the appearance of a beggar. And he's going into his palace to sort of case the joint to see how big of a problem he has. Well, he's got a huge one. There are 108 men in there all striving to become his wife's next husband. She's held out for 20 years. So he's a beggar. He's sort of over in a corner, sitting down, hoping that somebody will come and give him food. And Telemachus' statement means, look, you're a beggar. You need to eat and get food. Being modest and sitting over here's no good. You've got to be aggressive and go around and ask them at the table, which he does. It's a fascinating part of the Odyssey, which I hope everybody reads. And so Charmides says, oh, yeah, you're right. I would never disagree with Homer, but he should have, because what Telemachus says is modesty is not a good mate. That is to say, it's not good to be modest if you're a beggar.
Yeah.
So that's a special case.
Okay.
You can understand that for a beggar. But for normal people, you know, maybe modesty's just the thing. And you would hope that Charmides would say, but Socrates, it's a special case. We can't count that for a refutation. So, yes, yeah. I disagree with Homer.
Do you think there's a part of Charmides, because he was a young man and he knows Socrates' reputation?
That he was terrified?
Yeah, a little bit terrified, like, ah.
Yes.
Okay.
That could very well be part of it.
So he was like, let me just agree to get this thing over with.
And I hope I don't embarrass myself yep. too badly.
Yeah.
But he, after this second refutation, he was feeling that. So now he does a fairly clever thing.
Mm-hmm.
When Socrates asked for another definition.
Yeah. And modesty here, Professor, we are talking about modest in good, right? Because we don't want a modest in evil doing, in evil action. Because we say it's good to be modest in food, let's say. It's something you need, but you don't want to do too much of it.
Well, you don't want to be modest when you are begging for food. You want to be aggressive because you got to get the food. You're going to starve to death by just sitting in the corner and waiting. And
yeah.
you got to make yourself seen and
you
even be annoying. Right?
Yeah. Every time I'm thinking about modest, moderation, temperance, I'm thinking about good action.
Yes.
I was hoping Socrates is talking about only good. Because we don't want people to be like, oh, and instead of killing 20 million people, at least they just were modest enough to kill 10.
Yeah, right. But we should be thankful for that.
That's true, but we want you not to kill nobody.
Right. So modesty is a virtue. It
yeah.
is a good. So Charmides is not wrong about that. Again, to refer to our contemporary world, we don't live in a modest world, right?
Mm-hmm.
When I was growing up, just before the Civil War, It was a much more modest world.
Yeah.
People weren't so willing to jump up and wait, you know, stand out from the crowd by whatever means they had to do to become rich or famous or whatever it was.
Yeah.
And there's lots of examples. Sports, football players, you know, they make a tackle and they go on the field and have these celebration dances for making a tackle. That's what they're supposed to do.
Yeah.
Right? A modest football player, they'd make the tackle and then they'd go get back in their position. So that's the kind of difference we're talking about. Modesty is a virtue.
Okay.
And it's a virtue in ancient Athens.
And that was Charmides' second definition.
Right. So his third definition, he looks right at his guardian, right? Nothing subtle.
Yep.
Looks at his guardians and says, I have heard that it's
doing your own business.
Doing your own business. Minding your own business. And Socrates catches it, right?
Yep.
And he says, yeah, I know where you heard that. You got that from Critias. And
yep.
Critias denies it at first. But finally, he fesses up.
After Socrates basically said, that definition is kind of stupid.
Yeah, but Critias is willing to defend it. And in that defense, they go off on another topic. So we're not going to necessarily follow that line. But I want to talk a little bit more about the translation of minding your own business. In the Greek, it comes off more like doing what's of one's own self. Doing what's of one's own self. Now, if you think of it that way, right, it's yourself is your soul. So it's paying attention to your soul and what you are doing. So you can think of it like this in a way. As you're growing up, we come to decisions like, first one is you graduate from high school. What's of my own self is involved in the decision. What do I want to do with my life, in particular for a job or career? Here's where knowing yourself comes in again. You got to have some sense of things you might like to do, and also some sense of things you might be capable of doing, and some things you might be willing to do if all else fails. So the decision tree there is, one thing you can do is decide to go off to college, and that delays your decision somewhat, but you can't avoid it. And I observed this a lot when I was in undergraduate, is people change majors a lot. I was one of them, because you're exposed to things you never knew about before.
Oh, yeah.
So that sort of made you rethink the issue. The other branch is, well, I'm not going to college, so I need to go into the labor market. What might I be good at or like to do or be willing to do? And so that's the sense of minding your own business that we're talking about. It's on the basis of your self-understanding to act.
Okay.
Okay? That's not the sense that we usually give to minding your own business. We think a person who doesn't mind their own business is a busybody and interferes in everybody's life and all of that stuff. But I think the Greek aims at a different understanding of what doing one's own self means. But it's an interesting definition, and Critias starts out trying to defend it as well. But we know from, for example, having read The Republic, that very same thing, minding your own business, is defined in The Republic as justice, a different virtue. Mm-hmm. So if nothing else, Plato unavoidably forces you to think through things if you're paying any attention.
Yeah.
And he's also teaching you to pay attention and to become a very slow reader.
And definitely.
And that's a virtue.
Yeah.
Right?
Definitely, because, I mean, otherwise you're not going to see when things go off the rail.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know.
Like, I missed that one on the first definition of temperance there when Socrates was going through.
It's easy to miss if you're, you know, and the faster you read, the more you miss.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
So going back to knowing yourself. So Socrates did not think on this dialogue. Actually, he mentioned that a man who does not know himself, he cannot know what temperance is.
He cannot know because he doesn't know what his business of his own self is. And so you're at a loss if you don't understand yourself. You don't know what you like or why you like it or what you can do or how you might learn it or what you will accept in the worst case. And so you basically set yourself adrift.
Does that go to the rest of the virtues?
I think so. I think in my mind, this is the most important virtue. And I'm going to skip to a different dialogue to come up with a two-word definition that appears in the Laws, a very interesting but even longer than Republic dialogue. But in there, somebody suggests that sophrosyne is unburdened judgment. So let's think about that. Judgment is to make a decision, right? We all have a faculty of judgment. It's a God-given thing. And we have to use it all the time because the life can almost be defined as having to make a series of judgments. And not making a judgment is a judgment. So you're always in that situation. Well, what does unburdened mean? That means you're not affected by anything outside of your reason.
Okay. Ooh.
So there's two main things that affect our ability to reason. Our interior states of mind primarily. So imagine you're trying to make an important decision and you're really angry because the motor in your car just fell out and it's going to cost you $3,000 to get it fixed and you have to walk to work the next day. And your kids have been acting up and your dog's sick and all of that. And so you're in mental turmoil. Your mental state is a burden to make a clear decision. And we've all been there. And then there's external factors. People could be pressing you to make a quick decision and telling you what it should be. That can't help but be a burden on trying to make a decision. Just your society's customs and mores are a sort of passive burden because, remember, Charmides said, well, could make me feel ashamed. Well, what's shame after all? It's the ability to recognize you yourself have violated your society's customs.
Yeah.
So you don't want to do that because, you know, you've been taught all those customs. It feels really wrong to do that. So that's a burden. There can be all kinds of other external burdens, right? Your house starts to burn down and, you know, all kinds of things. So those are all burdens. But to make a good decision, you have to be able to quiet all the burdens. That goes back to Charmony's word, quiet.
Quietness, yep.
I have a quiet, settled mind, and I can therefore make a clear decision. I'll do it in an orderly way and maybe even a slow way, but I'll get to the right answer. That's the important part. It's not doing it fast or slow. It's doing it right. It's the only way you could come up with the right decision. Now, this carries through to one of our other favorite authors, Marcus Aurelius.
Mm-hmm.
He was a famous Stoic writer. He was also, incidentally, a Roman emperor, which is interesting. But Aurelius put it this way. We should each of us have an inner citadel, that's a fortress, in which we will find a calm, settled mental state regardless of any possible burden. We should develop that so that when we have to make decisions, we know how we can get to a place where we're unburdened and then we can get the right answer. So this all ties together in a kind of nice way. And that's the most sensible definition I've heard of Safra-Sein, because it goes right to the heart of what we are and why we should try to know ourselves. Do you know you have an inner citadel? Have you worked on constructing an inner citadel? Got to have some sense of that to do it. It's an interesting thought.
One thing he mentioned in there, and I want to see what your take is. He said, for the part can never be well unless the whole is well.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's popped up in modern discussions of medicine. Because, and it, you understand, physicians have certain specialties.
Yeah. Now, was he talking about the physical or was he talking about the soul?
Well, he says both.
Okay.
He said this Thracian that he talked to supposedly, you know, I can't heal your morning headache unless I take into account what's going on in the rest of your body. Like you're drinking wine like a fish at night. So you cure the headache by curing the drinking problem. But it's interesting to go further and say, I can't heal your body until your soul is right. And that's popped up again in modern literature. If you're under great stress, for example, and stress has been studied a lot, but only since the 70s or so, people started looking at it and say, gee, people under great stress tend to be sicker.
Yep.
What's going on? Well, stress itself can be debilitating to some of your physiological states. And while you're busy being stressed out, your body is being adversely affected, and you're so stressed out, you don't notice or can't find your inner citadel at all to determine what you should do to feel better. So it's interesting that concepts go way back 2,500 years.
Yeah, that's interesting.
It is interesting.
Now, is it a... Let me set this up before I ask that question. Aristotle also talking about temperance, moderation as a virtue. Mm-hmm. The way I'm thinking about moderation is like doing enough not to do too much or too little.
Correct.
How can you go wrong for being overly justice or overly having wisdom?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, for one thing, the things you mentioned are virtues. Can you be too good? You could be saintly, I guess. Mm-hmm. It'd be different. But I don't think anybody should complain about being overly good. The flip side, though, if you're overly bad or evil, that's sin, right? And so nobody's going to think that's a desirable state.
Okay.
Or the people that do, we really find rather horrifying. And there seem to be people like that occasionally, and we could probably all cite certain kinds of crimes that have occurred. That how evil do you have to be? How immoderate do you have to be to do something that terrible?
Yeah. Anything else you got on Charmides?
Yeah, this is a tough one, and it's worth a struggle to try to figure it out because it's so central to the moral thought of Plato and Socrates, for one, but that all applies to us as well. Mm-hmm. And so, actually, given the difficulty of the concept, we got through it pretty well.
Oh, yeah. The concept of moderation is, it's a whole different ballgame in the practice.
That's
just like everything
virtues,
else.
Right?
Yeah, I mean, I'm just looking even the issue we have in this country right now of overly eating. That's idea of moderation, overly drinking.
Yeah, we lack moderation in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
And we can then say that we lack Safra-Sein in a lot of ways because people are making bad decisions.
Is it a part of that we flipped from using reason or having reason before we make a decision, and then we went to the, what Plato say, reason, desire, and emotions?
Yeah.
Did we flip that upside down?
I think we have. And again, some of that's our own fault. I mean, there's no question about it. We could be more careful, and we could use reason more often.
Yeah.
Some of it is, again, the impact of society around us. Advertising, for example, is a concerted, massive effort to go around our reasoning capability to get us to buy stuff. If you don't think that's true, when you're watching TV and the commercial comes on, turn the sound off and watch. You'll get exactly what their message is. And
without the sound.
Without the sound. Yeah. So what they're saying is just blather. They're not trying to convince you this product is better because, and give you a reason to count, right? Because so much of what we buy are commodities. One beer is pretty much like the other, right? Yeah, there's some differences, but beer is beer is beer. Mm-hmm. So how do you sell that? Well, you got to associate the consumption of beer with having a lot of beautiful friends and partying. So how often have you seen a beer commercial where they're at a barbecue and there's a bunch of real handsome guys and real beautiful women and they're all laughing and having a good time and drinking the beer they're trying to sell you? So what's the implication? Drink our beer and you'll be able like to this. Enjoy this.
Yeah.
Yeah, good luck with that.
Yeah. So that's not the advertiser's fault. They do what works.
Well,
does that mean our society have lacked the ability to reason and they made the decision based on their desire and emotions?
I think there is blame to go to advertisers. They know they're going around reason.
Absolutely.
So in effect, they're saying we're better off as producers of stuff to have a society where people don't think too well.
Oh,
and they're encouraging that.
Yeah.
And so you get advertisers for everything. How about politics? Everything is spun these days, right? You don't hear anything where there's not an immediate counter interpretation, a competing narrative, they call it now. But often, neither of the competing narratives will hold up to reason. We're more influenced by stories, narratives, than we are by a logos, a reason to count. Mm-hmm. Because it's just the nature of human beings to love stories. And if you can tell me a good one, I'll go with that, right? If your story's not so good, I'll go not with that.
Yeah.
Without thinking through the issue, partly because they don't give you information, right?
Yeah. So the bottom line here is the human beings get influenced more by emotion and desire than reason.
Yes. I think that's pretty well understood by psychologists anyway.
And the advertisers knows that.
Yes, they do.
And they use that to their advantage.
Yes, and so do politicians and other folks that want to influence us.
In a free economy society, is there anything wrong the advertisers are doing? They're trying to sell a product, and they've got to do whatever best to do it.
We'd like to think that in a free market economy, that people would always act morally. Now, we know that that's not going to be totally true. Mm-hmm. But you would think the advertisers might be willing to present a reason to count and not try to influence in ways that they know are not right.
Yeah.
Right? So by running around reason and going to desire and in spirit, they know they can do that, but they know the effect on a society where you do that. In the end, not to their advantage, but it's irresistible.
Oh, yeah.
And I understand why.
That's all I have, Professor.
Eric, thank you again.
Thank you very much.
And the best editor. And it's a joy for me to be working with you.
I love
We're better off.
I love it. I'm enjoying it.
Yeah.
Yeah. See thank you, Professor.
Thank you, Eric. Yep.